Hi everyone, welcome back to the Lake Podcast. I'm your host, Karthik Nachu. We've got a great episode today on a very topical, relevant, and interesting book, A Social and Political History of TB from the 19th century till now. The book, The Phantom Plague, How Tuberculosis Shaped History, by journalist Vidya Krishnan, is at times a polemic, a tour de force overview of historical trends and events that have got us here with respect to TB, and a deep look on India, which is now the epicenter of tuberculosis globally, the number of cases both diagnosed and left undiagnosed going up, and how and why TB has worsened in India over the recent past. Krishnan does this by unpacking the political and bureaucratic gaps and failings that have resulted in the skyrocketing number of cases and deaths across the country. This is not an academic book. Thus far in this podcast, we've more or less looked at academic scholarly works. So far, this conversation and book, I hope, will be a departure from the recent spate of books covered in this podcast. That said, Phantom Plague is a necessary book that we should read to become better aware of the disease, TB, its past, its present and future, the latter, which is greatly influenced by prevailing structures of power and control, which work to limit the export of TB remedies, especially drugs, globally, to those in the developing world that need them urgently. As Krishnan writes in the book, the seemingly unassailable power and clout of Big Pharma works in conjunction with governments and international organizations to create and entrench systems and practices that imperil millions of people with TB by depriving them of access to required medicines. What's required now is nothing short of a rethink, maybe a restructuring or a dismantling of the global health establishment as we know it, to bring about meaningful change on infectious diseases like TB. Here is Vidya Krishnan on The Phantom Plague, How Tuberculosis Shaped History. Yeah, I want to just start by asking, so you're a health journalist and you've been covering the health beat in India for a while, and now global health as well. At what point does it dawn on you that I have enough material for a book, and how does that evolve from there? What's the process like?
That's a tough one. At what, there's no one point, because my process mostly is with this book. I had reported on the story, which is chapter 7 of the book, which is a teenage girl takes the government to court to access a new TB therapy, bedaquiline, which I write about. So that's what I was reporting on. That was a news part of the story, but it was nowhere near the book. And I started reading more about TB, and the next 4 years I was just reading about pandemics, which incidentally would come in handy. And at some point I realized I had 23,000-25,000 words, and I was still looking at it as a work of investigative journalism and not as nonfiction narrative book. And it took a while for me to it took a while for me to reconceive it as a much bigger project, which like goes all the way back 100 years in history, but also spanning across continents to New York. Then I had to kind of sit down and restructure the book in my mind. It took me a while to get there, but once I did it, I remember writing the entire book in a 30-day period. So what I was doing before that was I just had one document where I was just dumping everything, but there was just no structure or order. And at some point in end of 2018, I could see the book a little bit more clearly. Like the historical tangents had come into place, and I knew what I wanted. And mid of I finished writing the first draft in May 2019, so like 6 months before the pandemic hit. And thank God for that, because between the reporting on the pandemic and the writing of the book, it's just been a blur the last 3 years. Mostly been a blur. So
Did you intend to write a history of TV initially or no?
I did. I would like to say yes. It's just so difficult to answer this in hindsight, because I'm not sure how much of that is me just winging it now that I'm on the other side. But I tend to look at history for to make sense of what's happening right now. And my training is in sociology, and I rely a lot on medical history. So there was like a couple of years of when I was just reading the Justinian plague of the 15th century, and then I went like century by century by century. And if you are a sociologist by training, what you see are patterns, plague after plague. And I find that fascinating. And a lot of it has nothing to do with science. So it's mostly xenophobia and paranoia and magical thinking. And all of it is, it just lives in this gray area, which you can't tell as a science reporter. And so what a book then does is allows me to go crazy on an empty canvas. And that's what you see.
So this is a book about TB, right? And the bacteria that causes TB has been around since the 1870s, as you write in the history. And the drugs to treat it have been around here for decades, right? And yet TB kills more than 1 million people every year. I think it was the biggest infectious disease killer before COVID came along. And the book really lays out this history of TB through the decades, but it's also, in my view, a clarion call to look at TB socially and politically through the pathologies of power and control that allowed this scourge to persist today, especially in the developing world. So talk to us about the book's framing, right? That kind of zooms in on these hierarchies and inequities of race, class, and caste to understand TB's endurance.
Well, thank you for that question. I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I feel one of the reasons the book is resonating in this way with the readers is because I know as much medicine as the reader does. I'm not a student of medicine, and this entire book is basically an attempt. TB is a very difficult story to tell. It's not a sexy disease. It's not something where there's more funding. It's not like HIV. It's not dramatic in those ways. So this was, I knew very well that I would have to put like a big, powerful engine, like a narrative engine, to hook the reader in before I get to like the really boring and the miserable and the wretched and the painful. And and that's what that was always the intention, to tie to look at the interplay of race and caste and gender. And it's just impossible to talk about infectious disease interventions without placing it in the racial context of our times. And essentially, I genuinely do believe, as a storyteller, this is a story about TV, but my craft is to tell a story, not a student of medicine. And I came to it with that very single purpose, that you just have to keep digging on until you find stories. Science is almost incidental in the book. And I spoke to my editors about it repeatedly, saying the science has to be the broccoli that you slip into the meal. It's just happening incidentally in the background, but what's actually happening is Ignaz Semmelweis is living a miserable life, and the poor guy doesn't deserve it. So I kind of wanted, you don't need to understand law or medicine to understand injustice, and that's what that's the kind of story I wanted to tell. Because as a newspaper reporter, you are very constrained by how you tell a story, and my whole reason for having this broad canvas was to then not handicap myself into tight spots, that this is the only format. So if you've read the book, it's like a Russian doll of stories. So you start from one place, but there is a story within one, and it keeps unspooling in that way. And I am glad the readers say they like it, and I'm glad they do. I was very careful not to make it boring, because TV to begin with is boring. And so you find like Victorian fashion and Sherlock Holmes and Dracula, and I found like all sorts of pop culture and crammed it into the first part of the book. And I feel like all the fun and games end with the first part, and then it just gets really reportage heavy, and the final section of the book is very commentary heavy. So a lot of feedback that I've got, and in fact a lot of reviews, are like very three broad sections. So you either have readers who are physicians or come from a medical angle, and they're like, this is such a long drawn out tangent about the intellectual property waiver, and it's just so dragging the book down, and I thought it would be more about medicine. And then there are lay readers who pick up the book for the Dracula and the fun bits, and they're like, oh my God, it just gets so dense so soon. And then there is a third part who are policymakers, who like, there's just too much, there's just too much literature and art and fun. So I feel like the fact that no party is fully happy says something there.
So I read a review. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal. And he liked the book, and he liked the books that focused on India and the stories that you tell on people in India who've been dealing with TB. But he wasn't so convinced by the larger global frame that you've kind of encased the story he's in, right? I think he called it a polemic, if I remember correctly, or maybe it was another, was some other review. But for him, it was too critical for its own good. Did you read that review, or what was your take on that?
I did. I read the review. I was surprised that overall Wall Street Journal ended up liking the book, because that's, again, it's such a fascinating difference for me, because the book has now been out 2 months in India, and I've had a bunch of reviews in Indian publications, and there's a lot across India and and abroad. There is a lot of, oh, this is rhetoric heavy and so much polemic and incandescent rage. There was one of that. And it's 2022, but we are calling female authors angry. And I kind of tend to not pay a lot of attention to it. What fascinates me is that every Western review has called it polemic heavy when towards the ending portion of it, where I'm talking about global health and race and intellectual property laws. Whereas every Global South review has looked at the book, and they are talking, they focus, like the Indian reviewers focus on the bit in Mumbai and how bad things are and how I'm critiquing the government. But the portion that comes after, they're like, yeah, that totally makes sense. Of course, that needed to be said. That's not even open to question. So to a point that they don't even comment on it. So if you see the Indian Express review, it doesn't even comment on the rhetoric. There's no, oh, the rhetoric is too much, because that to Indian, if you are a brown or black government, or you are, or even a newspaper that's reporting so much TV, it's very difficult to look at what's being said as quote unquote angry without like seeing the context of what's being said. And actually, a lot of people say that it's not an angry book. Like I said, the first part was just me having fun talking about Sherlock Holmes and a bunch of things I wrote about just because I like there is an Anthony Bourdain reference. So what you find in the book is just things I was having fun with. And the thing is, I report, I've been sitting with this subject for 7, 8 years, so I process it through writing. But I do understand that the reader feels a lot of anger when they read it. And that's intended as well. But I try to say that it doesn't make me angry. It's just this is the state of affairs. It is when you put these things in conversation, there is enough blame to pass around. And it's not a neat story. It's a messy story where regional governments in India and South Africa have their own share of blame. But the global health structures need to be questioned at this point because they are serving no one but themselves and mostly shareholders. So,
were you worried about access and speaking with people in the global health architecture as you were writing this at that point? Because my guess is they probably won't be as interested in speaking to you. And for them, and for many who are worried about funding and whether they are their funding might be curtailed if they are too open about their projects and how money is spent. How did you get around that?
Oh, with difficulty. So I remember struggling for months to try and get to access USAID in particular, which has funded this donation policy that India has on bedaquiline, the new TB drug I write about in the book. But then, it's not easy to be, these are the conversation I actually do want the book to force. So thank you for this question. If you are a brown health reporter or a black health reporter, what essentially happens is WHO just ignores the questions you send. With the book, I remember chasing USAID for months. Eventually, they did have a conversation with me. It did not make it to the book because nothing came out of it. But even before we got to the point, there were questions like, who's paying you to write the book? And why do you want to write the book? And these are questions like which they use to clear journalists with whom they speak. And with TB in particular, but with all sorts of infectious disease in Global South, you know how annually there are these junkets where brown reporters and black reporters are flown into these conferences, like the AIDS conferences happening in Montreal, and they all happen in these countries where there is not enough disease burden. So they create these hurdles and they give these fellowships to black and brown journalists to quote unquote train them. When the truth is black and brown journalists are living and reporting within those communities, they don't need training, but WHO, Stop TB, all of these organizations, Gates Foundation, fund these training programs. And there's so much of their focus is in training the natives as against when black and brown journalists come in with questions about malpractices that their organizations are doing in India. And then there are no answers. So there was a lot of, I faced that routinely as a brown reporter. I'm sure it's a universal experience. Because again, you look at World Science Journalists Forum, these conferences happen in Switzerland. And what are you talking about if you're having conferences about science and infectious diseases where there are no black and brown people? And what happens is when you have no black or brown storytellers, you don't have a policy view of what's happening in these, Uttar Pradesh is known as a graveyard of the pilots because all pilot projects go there to die. That's how much money Gates Foundation has put into it. So when a reporter from UP will mail a question to Seattle, it's not treated with equal importance. And these are all things that go into framing a story. And I would really, with Phantom Plague, I genuinely believe that you can't defeat good stories. You can't send tanks after it, or it's a good story, you can't defeat it. And the challenge then becomes when you have organizations that don't talk to you is to find a way to still tell the story. So this is not entirely on WHO or USAID or these organizations, because my own government also did not want to talk to me. So I used right to information queries, and what you see in the book is basically piecing together, which is why there is so much focus on interplay of things. So you see where politics meets science, and you see this, waltz of science and social science through the book. And I think all of that was, just a response to the reporting environment we are in. We just don't have the kind of freedom.
The other thing that came to mind was, especially from a global health point of view, we've become accustomed to talking about NCDs more these days, right? Whether it's heart disease, cancer, or diabetes. I mean, the focus appears to be shifting more along those lines as major disease burdens, right? Was that something that you also kind of saw and confronted from people within the field, and that, you know, why are you still focusing on TB when you have these other diseases which appear to be kind of, you know, just accelerating, especially in developing countries like India now?
I mean, if you're the person who for 7 years have been telling everyone, you know, that you're writing a book on TB, the first question invariably is not what are you writing, it's just why. Why not, you know, and it's always why TB, because it's just also, it's so difficult to make sense of. But it was never why TB and not cancer, it's just, you know, why TB. I actually don't think, the thing is, with the pandemic, we are now in a position where there is a focus on respiratory infectious diseases like it's just never been before.
Yeah.
So that's changed. But, you know, I try not to look at this as like a zero-sum game where if you focus on NCDs, this will, you know, if you give that more, this will lose. That is not the problem we have. This is not an issue of dearth of resources. It's essentially at its structural root, we just have for disease after disease, like cancer patients also are fighting the same battle to access cancer drugs that TB patients are fighting to access bedaquiline. And we are not having a universal conversation. The conversation is not, you know, disease by disease. That's again, TB is a case in point. I jump off of TB and TB happens to be an infectious disease. But the book is essentially the malignancy at the core of our global health structures is that it serves only the global north, first of all. But even within global north, it doesn't extend the courtesy to minority communities. So African American neighborhoods have a completely different and disproportionate disease burden. Like in Canada, you have Inuit communities that suffer from TB more. So this is not about the disease. This is essentially about our willingness to not save people unless it is profitable for someone. And we've seen that entirely all of it has come to pass, by whether it be TB or cancer or HIV. All of it has come to pass in COVID. Pharma companies and CEOs, yesterday I was seeing the story about how much money pharma CEOs have made last year. And this is not a system that you can, on good faith, say serves the black and brown people who are the most vulnerable. So the drugs are not where the disease is, and the political interests are not aligned. And I say in the book that the moral arc of the universe doesn't bend towards justice. It has to be broken to it. And I feel like with now two pandemics, tuberculosis is a pandemic. We don't use that word for it. And now there's monkeypox virus has been declared a public health emergency as well. We are now at a tipping point where we can't like walk on eggshells about is this a polite conversation to have? Frankly, that's a lot of, I get a lot of this question that the book says very many bold things, but I was not saying it for an audience. I was just saying what I was seeing, and what you read in the book is how I explain what is happening to communities in India to myself. I did not write it for an audience, and I, at this point, it really does not upset me if they get offended by it. So
the parts of the book that focus on India are heartbreaking, riveting, and also infuriating, right? I think India, as you write, is now the epicenter of TB. I want to get to the stories of Pia and Shreya in a bit, but before that, is a story of how the Indian government deals with TB now. Sort of systemic neglect, and the callousness, which you write, of some health policies, especially rationing of TB drugs for various reasons. At the same time, there's an antibiotic policy since 2011 that does not seem to be very effective at all. How and why does this rationing take place, and how is it justified? And I'd expect more political outrage around this, but I don't see that either. Why?
Well, why does the rationing take place? Essentially because India, which is a pharmacy of the world, in fact, bedaquiline's patent is owned by an American pharmaceutical company called Johnson & Johnson. But they manufacture the drug in India in a factory in, I think it's Nagpur. But anyway, in a factory in India. And just outside that factory, people are dying, patients are dying of TB. And it is because our government has increasingly become pliant to big pharma, where as against the 90s, where Cipla took Pfizer to court and challenged their patent on antiretrovirals and made a generic version at $1 a day and then exported it to Africa, we are now in a position where Indian domestic pharma manufacturing companies don't challenge patents. They just sign deals with pharmaceutical companies. And these pharmaceutical companies in the US outsource the manufacturing to India because, firstly, it's an environmentally harmful industry. Secondly, India does it at a fraction of a rate. And then what we have done is our national policy for tuberculosis depends on a donation from the pharmaceutical company. And it's a hostage crisis. So when you create this kind of the thing with donation is it can just disappear at the whim of a pharmaceutical company. And we have a government that has not protected the interest of someone who's very vulnerable, which is the TB community. And we also have a TB community, which also is dealing with the pandemic right now. And they can't launch the kind of resistance movement that HIV community launched. So the HIV within public health, the HIV movement is one of the most successful patient advocacy movement. And we see the beginnings of it in India, and I write about that in the book. But why is the rationing happening is because our government has failed our patients. And why do you not see resistance to it? You know, that's a more complicated question, but the starting point of that is there is not enough information. So with this government in particular, it's so difficult to report about TB or about any policy, in fact. But also the information is just reporting in India is just so jargonized when it is there. I write in the book about how, you know, you keep focusing on numbers like X lakh and X million people, and you don't, you know, take it to a very personal story that what happens when someone goes deaf, 1 in 4 people go deaf, and that's a treatable, preventable disease. And we have a policy that's maiming our own people. And it should raise a lot of uncomfortable questions to people who are in the policymaking space in TB. I hope it does. I know the patient activists who I have profiled in the book are very angry, and they are raising the same questions. And there is a fledgling global movement. What's happened with COVID now is there is so much awareness about respiratory diseases that I remain optimistic. I do see a global movement come out of all of this.
The other thing is that it's almost as if India's health architecture, I mean, how the governance structures are designed and as they exist now, almost fuels TB more than it controls. Right? I mean, I was struck by the irony, which you write in the book, by how India's public sector hospitals, which are much better at treating TB, right, but Indians still prefer the private hospitals that are rapacious, extractive, and don't actually report the number of cases of TB to the government themselves, right? And this private sector has actually made this epidemic much worse through underdiagnosis and over prescription, right? And the term you use here is and you call it leaky cascade, this whole architecture here, is that where things get worse for patients because you see failings at every level of care, right?
Yeah. The it's not my term, leaky cascade is something now TB researchers use, because what essentially happens is you have a cough and then you're not diagnosed, or you're misdiagnosed and you're treated with antibiotics that make it resistant, and you bounce around from your GP to your some other doctor to some other doctor, never thinking that you should actually go to a government facility. And I have a character in the book, a doctor who I interviewed, who says that a patient told him that, you know, the government facility may be free, but it's the kind of free we cannot afford. Because you go to a government hospital and they rob you of your dignity and they treat you badly and you have to wait and it's scary and intimidating. And so you choose the easier option and go to the private sector where you are treated till your insurance policy basically runs out. And neither of those things are good. And both of these things are fueling our TB crisis, because the government has completely abdicated its job of regulating this sector. Tuberculosis has been a notifiable disease since 2012. We've had an antibiotic policy since 2011, but there is no implementation. And what happens in most rural and semi-urban cities in India, and I met so many patients of this kind, that they their first point of contact with the healthcare provider is the chemist, who they go and tell that, you know, they go to the nearest pharmacy and they say, this is what's happening, give me something. And that person's not a doctor. And what we have then cumulatively is a situation like this, where drugs are not effective. And we are looking at a very dangerous situation where more and more patients are facing a version of this disease that can't be treated. And the drugs that do treat them are locked in patent monopolies. So there is like the odds are just so stacked against a patient that by the time they survive, you know, one chemotherapy, and many of the patients I interview have had relapses, they have to know intellectual property law, they have to know antimicrobial resistance, they have to teach themselves so much. And it's just an unfair burden of a very unkind and inhumane policy. And there is enough blame to go around, but most of it lies with the Indian government. Now what has happened with COVID is that down to the last CBNAT machine, gene expert machine, everything has been taken by COVID. So our TB diagnosis has fallen, our patients are missing. So experts are now saying within a year or two, this is going to boomerang very, very badly. And we, in fact, are cutting health budgets. So yeah, it looks really grim at this point. And we have a lot of cause to be worried, especially if we live in, you know, crowded cities.
The book, as I mentioned, unpacks the intersection of race, caste, and class, and medicine, and how these conditions interact with medicine to produce outcomes with respect to TB. There's one intersection here that's strewn into the book through the stories of women, Pia, Shreya, and Nandita, and that's the intersection of gender and medicine. It'd be great if you can expand on how gender interacts with disease, in this case TB, and the effects of that in India.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Again, with TB, there are just so many aspects I met. So, yeah, so a portion of the book is set in the slums in Mumbai, in Govandi. I spent a lot of time there meeting patients who were coming to the DOTS clinic. And over and over and over again, you see male patients who are dealing with a terrible illness, but then they're just dealing with how their body is failing them and how the system is failing them. But when a female patient comes along, I met so many young women whose in-laws had sent them back saying they've become infertile because they have TB, which is a myth. It does not happen. There was one woman who, while I was reporting the book, died because her husband kept trying to have a child. And her TB was not cured, but she kept getting pregnant and having miscarriages and eventually died. And this all of that is also TB. Most of all, in the slums of Mumbai, women get more TB because they are more homebound. As against, if your husband is an auto rickshaw driver, he still spends the entire day out. And all of these things kind of make women in particular, but lower caste women especially, very, very vulnerable to this disease. And I actively picked a protagonist in the book who kind of decenter the view of how the policy makers imagine a TB patient, because starting from WHO, the whole burden on dots is that the patient has to keep turning up for 6 months at the same place. They will lose their job. They will be stigmatized, as against every other disease. In HIV, you get the medicine, you go home, and the doctor trusts that you will eat it. You will have your medicine on time. TB patients face a lot without any support from the community. And it's really heartbreaking to see very, very young women, their lives are destroyed by it. And they get no support, because even if, as a male patient, you fall ill, you have a female caregiver. Whereas if, as a female, you fall ill, you don't find caregivers as well. So you're more likely to approach the health system late, because there's literally no one to take you to the hospital. You're more likely to get there in a worse condition, and you're more likely to die. All of these things are not just true for TB, they're true across diseases for women, but particularly for women of the lower caste.
Nandita's story was really hard to read, but also heartening given what she's doing now and where she is. The one thing I got from her experience was that we seldom hear, as you mentioned, about the stories of individuals who have lived through TB and how horrifying and difficult their experiences were. I mean, her treatments from the TB drugs, which she was prescribed, left her with some really hard side effects, including deafness. Right? Why do we not hear more stories of people with TB? Maybe the politics of TB in India, I mean, especially requires us to center their stories and experiences, right, to move the needle when it comes to treatment and diagnosis.
I agree. This one, I cannot blame the policymakers or the government or the doctors. This is on how we tell stories. And we just in India have the thing with Indian newsrooms is, first of all, health reporting before the pandemic is not something no newsrooms don't dedicate exclusive resources to health reporting. So very few newsrooms, even to this day, 3 years into the pandemic, actually have a health editor. It's a very technical beat. So you will have like sports editors and legal editors, but no health editors. And a lot of focus when there are health editors or weekend health pages is on, stories like very caste and class related stories. So, oh, it's hard, drink coconut water, keep warm, hydrate, do this yoga. It's not public health. It's not putting people at the center. There is no public in public health left. And how we tell stories is why we are in this place. Most of the people in Bombay don't know that Bombay is the epicenter of a global hotspot for TB, and that's a failing of the storytellers. But all of that I'd like to believe is changing, because again, health, I will say, is one of the few beats in India. Which is again like how it shows how sexist Indian newsrooms are. So over the last 2 decades, you see more women on health beats, because these are considered quote unquote softer beats. So, foreign correspondents or conflict reporting, you'll have men. Whereas, this health reporting, you gave it to women. And that's actually the reason why the pandemic reporting in India has actually been stellar. So Wire in particular, there are so many good young reporters who have been at it for 3 years. And these are young women who have been reporting on this, and they are getting better with every year. So this is changing, but it's a failure. Like I said, there is enough blame for everyone to go around, including storytellers.
It's also hard to read this book given what we've experienced with COVID the last 2 years. I think, as you mentioned, both are respiratory diseases that could have been controlled and managed now with the vaccines around us. Yet the barriers and hurdles around vaccine production and distribution through aspects like TRIPS, the power of Big Pharma, the role of the Gates Foundation, the WHO's diminution have all contributed to how we've kind of dealt with COVID globally, right? Do you think this experience has rocked us enough to move quickly the next time a respiratory disease like COVID comes around? Or will these structural deficits persist? And I mentioned that you spend time in the book on Gates and his work in global health, a very critical take, one of the few out there. And I think the ideas and forces that have placed Gates at the center of global health will only intensify further, especially given his influential role through COVID and its treatment, right? I think states all over the world have only become more beholden to Big Pharma, those producing vaccines, which have, as you mentioned, amassed considerable power. And their interests, I don't think, will be subordinated going forward, right? So how do we deal with this, in the future?
It's an interesting that's an interesting question about how do I see what will happen when the next pandemic hits? Because like this is with climate change and the permafrost melting, this is now we are at a point where this is just not tenable. And at least in the global south, in the developing countries, there are a bunch of people who have come together because of COVID in response to COVID, which is lawyers and, which includes intellectual property lawyers, but it also includes journalists and doctors and physicians from the global south. So if you see African nations now know that they can neither rely on India nor on WHO to get vaccines. So they have to invest in their own mRNA hubs. And the kind of R&D investment that you see in African nations is just unprecedented. And what we are seeing now is unprecedented historical mobilization that has happened in post-colonial nations, which is where it's impossible to talk about global health structure without the racism that is just baked inside the structure. All of the global health organizations are based in the global north. So of course, Gates, which is the biggest funder of WHO, which is also has huge stakes in World Trade Organizations and has see people who are on the board who are CEOs of pharma companies, they all take like decisions in closed door meetings that are peppered with, clash of interest. And what I now see is that because of the pandemic, we are at a point that this has to just be addressed or endured. And this status quo is not tenable anymore. And again, I go back to history a lot. NHS was born post-war because of the ravages of war. And we are having these conversations where increasingly post-colonial nations are realizing that they cannot depend on global health structures. So each continent will have to have its own manufacturing facility for vaccines so that it doesn't have to depend on global supply chains that will reliably fail. And I feel like there will be there is a beginning of it already with the TRIPS negotiation was so acrimonious. I recently wrote a piece about it in The Atlantic, about what that says about the power imbalance. All of this has been exposed for what it is, and all of it has been undergirded by philanthropy, which is why I spend a lot of time on Gates Foundation, because it's just so toxic. It's very clear that with infectious diseases in particular, there is a colonial history of why tropics and post-colonial nations are seen as places which are diseased and plagued with unovercomable challenges. As against if you have the same Ebola or monkey virus or a measles outbreak in New York, you can very quickly arrive at solutions. In the book, I was lucky enough to speak to Dr. Paul Farmer towards the end of the book, and he speaks very presciently and very specifically about it. Dr. Farmer repeatedly said that we are actually not weighed down by the big pharma. We are not. They are the enemy, so to speak, in this battle between patients and patents. We are anchored down by people within the global health who are in our team, development economists and think tanks, who have low aspirations. They are lowballing, and they would do none of this if they were, valuing Black and Brown lives as precious as they do for Caucasian lives. That is the truth. That is the truth for TB, and it is true for HIV. It's true for COVID. And we can either go the next 10 years having this conversation, disease after disease after disease, because I'm here, I'm happy to patiently sit down and take it down Ebola and go disease after disease, or we can talk about the structural problem, which is that we cannot legislate life-saving medicines the way we legislate copyrights on movies and iPhones and refrigerators or whatever. And this is just not going to continue. I don't see it continuing. I know I'm rambling at this point. What I'm saying is that movements are born out of these kind of tensions, and I'm glad that things have been brought to head, which then means they will be addressed.
What was the hardest part of writing the book?
Watching patients die. I lost a lot of patients while people I was interviewing, and then in the end Dr. Farmer also passed away very tragically. And I've seen a lot of people die while reporting this book. So, that's actually where the morality, that's actually where this book is not for the living or the audiences who think I'm angry. It's for the dead. And I dedicate it to the dead because sure, people can find it angry or upsetting or not polite. That's the point where the argument has to be politely explain to you, So, yeah.
And finally, what's next? What are you working on now? Are you thinking about another book sometime in the future?
That's not a nice question. I just want to put that out there to ask. I'm not even done promoting the book. I miss reporting a lot, so I want to get a few years of reporting before I get back to. I mean, I can't even think of another book right now. My brain just hurts when I think about it.
Maybe how India has dealt with COVID. I know that you've written a lot of pieces on that over the last little while, right? And that's something that wants to know more.
I wrote for Caravan recently about that. It's just I think I'm ready to take a break from health stories for a while. Yeah.
Vidya, thank you so much.
Thank you for this interesting conversation. This was fun.
And that was Vidya Krishnan, the author of The Phantom Plague, How Tuberculosis Shaped History. I'm Karthik Nachipan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.